nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, first let's talk a little bit about electrostatics in fluids. The biggest difference about electrical potentials and electrostatics in fluids is that ions in the fluid are free to move around. And so when you actually have a particle with charge properties on it, it's not the electrical potential at the surface, it's the electrical potential outside the surface plus the counter ions of opposite charge that form around that, for example, cell. And in particular, most cells in your body are going to have a net negative electrical charge. So they're going to tend to be surrounded by positively charged ions such as sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium, zinc, a variety of basically positively charged ions that move around. And then you'll find that those counter ion atoms will actually associate with the cell surface and move physically with the particle. So when you're actually moving a nanoparticle or a cell through fluid, it's not only the actual physical boundaries, but there's actually a layer beyond the regular physical boundaries of either the nanoparticle or the cell that actually constitutes a hydrodynamic radius, meaning what is the radius actually in a fluid. So it's moving not only itself, but also some of the surrounding fluid, which stays in a layer around it. And so we have to be very conscious of that. And as part of that, we actually have a potential at the actual surface here of the cells, which I said usually is negatively charged. And then we have basically a electrical potential away from that of the immediate counter ions that are on the surface. And then finally, we have a electrical potential that actually occurs at the slip plane of all the atoms that go along with the actual particle when it moves. So all of this has to be taken into account. And effectively, you're sitting outside the nanoparticle at a distance and perceiving its charge. And that's what's going to happen when we make nanoparticles that go to particularly when we're targeting them to cells. And we want them, in general, we'll talk about the charge properties, but as I mentioned to you, the electrical, zeta potential of cells, most cells in your body are going to be slightly negatively charged in the range of about minus 20 millivolts. And what you're going to do is also have a negatively charged nanoparticle, because if in the body, we don't want them just sticking to everything. So in general, we'll take the same charge so that we have some electrical repulsion there, and then we will actually use targeting molecules to bind to receptors to actually pull the nanoparticles across an electrical repulsion zone so that they're only going to interact when they have a receptor. Now, when I say that, I want to keep in mind, for those of you who are just trying to transfect nanoparticles or molecules into cells and tissue culture, and you have maybe only one type of cell, then you want to actually do the opposite strategy. There you want those molecules or nanoparticles to stick immediately onto the cells, so you'll take a net positive charge on those molecules or nanoparticles so that they immediately come in. There's no point in having a repulsion because you're not doing any targeting anyway. You just want every cell to be labeled. But the minute you don't want every cell, when you're trying to actually target to subpopulations, which also is something that you do when you test your systems in vitro, you'll take typically mixed types of cells. You may have some cancer cells mixed in with normal cells, and then you want to test to see if your nanoparticles actually go to the cancer cells. In that case, you want to have back the original strategy of a negative zeta potential on your nanoparticles or molecules so that they can basically only attach where there is some positive receptor targeting molecule, like an antibody going for a receptor, to pull it across the potential barrier. So keep that very much in mind. That's something of confusion people want to understand. I gave a talk this summer to the Electrostatic Society, and they're used to dealing always with electrostatics in air. And it's a very, very different phenomenon when you have fluid involved, because it's like you really can't have high charge potentials because you're constantly surrounded by a fluid which is going to effectively short circuit all of the voltage differences to a point. Now, what people will do to balance this counter-ion effect is they'll make things effectively like a capacitor. They'll add protein in the fluid. So typically, if you're doing in vitro experiments, you'll add some protein like bovine serum albumin as a little protein source that actually acts as an insulator. And that way you can keep these charge properties pretty local and, again, prevent some agglomeration. In the body, that's never a problem because your blood is just full of proteins. And those proteins are going to naturally act as insulators. But this is also why, by the way, zeta potential, should you actually prepare cell samples and you label them and you do this in something like phosphate buffered saline, if there's no protein source and you put a relatively small number of cells in there and you centrifuge, you say, where's my pellet? Where did it go? Well, the reason is it never got to the bottom because it went electrostatically to the sides of the tube and it never made it to the centrifuge step. So you lost your whole sample before you ever centrifuged it because of zeta potential. So how do you get around that? You put in, again, some protein source, enough of it so that it keeps it away from the walls, typically plastic walls, and then you're able to recover your sample. But that's one of those mysteries is experiment, or if you haven't done that before, where you wonder, where did my cells go? So here's what we're really trying to do in the course. We're really trying to have a nanoparticle that we have all of the different layers, core materials, targeting molecules, but then at the end of all of that, when we make that construct, we have a net zeta potential charge on that, which is going to govern how it approaches a cell surface. And you'll notice this cell surface, you see all these positive charges. That's not the cell surface. The cell surface is mostly negative charges, but these are the counter ions that the particle has to get across those counter ions, interact with, and then if this particle is somewhat negatively charged, then there'll be electrical repulsion, and then we have to have a targeting molecule which reaches across that electrical repulsion to be able to grab hold and to specifically target. So keep that model in mind. So in terms of the importance of zeta potentials, it's the interaction of all particles in a fluid environment, which includes nanoparticle-nanoparticle interactions. And when you actually synthesize nanoparticles, you'll typically have them in some kind of a solution in a bottle on the shelf. And they may be very monodispersed because you've done a good job of designing them, and you have a zeta potential which keeps them all nicely apart so they don't bunch up or agglomerate together. And that looks very good when it's on the bottle, and then you add it to your cells and all of a sudden the nanoparticles all agglomerate up into one big mess and your experiment is over. And the reason for that is that when you put them out of their initial environment, you may have put them into a different pH, a different ionic strength, and then the zeta potential may change drastically. And all of a sudden, the zeta potential is exactly wrong for what you want. So then it's a showstopper. Your experiment's over, and you start all over again. And when we talk about nanoparticle-cell interactions, we're talking about the zeta potential of the nanoparticle and the zeta potential of the cell. And I mentioned to you that usually the cell is negatively charged, but cells vary a lot. So you need to know about something about the zeta potentials of the cells that you're trying to target. And sometimes when cells are in a tissue and they lay down a so-called extracellular matrix, they can sometimes lay down a fairly positively charged extracellular matrix. depending on what the tissue or organ is. So you need to know that when you design your nanoparticle so that you may want to have the nanoparticle actually change its charge function a little bit in different ionic strength environments or different pH environments. And there's ways that we can do that. We can dynamically change the zeta potential of a particle by using amphiphilic molecules on the surface that can change their charge properties with different conditions. So, as I mentioned to you, a very critical part of this process of the zeta potential is that we want to have a zeta potential that's adequate to keep it from agglomerating. We want to keep, if we have it very highly negatively charged and we put nanoparticles into the human bloodstream, then there are a lot of positively charged proteins that are going to start sticking all over those particles. And when that happens, that's a very bad thing. That basically, when proteins stick, it's a process called opsonification. And that opsonification is the first step that the body's immune system uses to actually eliminate foreign particulates in the bloodstream. So what we want is we want that nice minus 20 millivolts, which is, or 30, minus 30 millivolts on the bench. When we put it in blood, it'll typically drop quite a bit from that because there are going to be proteins, some things that are going to bind to it. But we want to bring it down into a range where it's no longer at high concentration like it is in the bottle. So as it disperses in the blood, the chances for agglomeration are a lot less. And now what we want to do is fine tune it so that the zeta potential has the properties that it's going to have a long circulation time. Meaning the last thing we want is for the immune system to, through the process of opsonification and binding those proteins, blood proteins, to take those nanoparticles out. So we want to hide it. So quite often what we will do is we'll also make sort of a, if you will, a non-sticky surface. And I've mentioned to you before, using so-called stealth layers, like polyethylene glycol on the outside, which tends to resist depositions of serum proteins on that, so that you can get a longer circulation time. And then lastly, a very low zeta potential leads to low serum protein binding and a potentially longer circulation. So if we take our minus 20 or 30 millivolts and we bring it down to maybe minus 5 to minus 10, then we're going to improve. At that point, we've already dispersed the particles in the bloodstream, so you can't get agglomeration where there aren't a lot of nanoparticles in close proximity. Then you want to have it adjust the zeta potential down to the range of about minus 5 to minus 10 so that you don't get a huge amount of protein deposition. So you got to think about that. You start out with something that looks good in the bottle and the bench in your lab, but by the time it gets in the bloodstream, it's going to change its zeta potential anyway. And what you want to do is make sure it comes down into a thing such that it's still negatively charged, but you want to have not so much of a negative charge that it's going to deposit proteins. So if we think about the zeta potential properties of the nanoparticles, remembering that the zeta potential is the electrical potential at the shear layer. That's the shear is where the boundary where the molecules in the solution, in the solvent, or in the bloodstream actually move physically with the particle as opposed to the nearby molecules of the fluid which don't move. So that's where that boundary is. And then this, again, always when people will, whenever you, hopefully after this class, whenever you hear somebody upset that their particles agglomerated, meaning they stuck together, the first thing you'll say, your zeta potential was wrong. Okay, so then they'll say, that's fine, now tell me about zeta potential. And then you'll be able to give them a lecture on zeta potential and how they should maybe change the charge properties of what they're doing. Okay, so, and again, we're adding layer by layer assembly. So every time we add a layer, remember, we're looking at the net electrical charge outside and with the counter ions. And so the effect of all the inner layers is going to be felt at some point. And so you've got to determine that. And so every time you design a layer, you'll have to check its zeta potential and see what you've done to it. After a while, you get pretty good at this. And sometimes you may say, well, I've finished construction of my particle. my nanoparticle, but it still has a bad zeta potential. Now what do I do? Well, in some cases, you may just add extra molecules that have the appropriate charge in order to get the zeta potential into the right range. They may actually not be molecules. They may be what we would call extra molecules rather than ones that you had implicitly in your design. So think about that. Hopefully, the best thing to do is to design it in mind so that everything you add comes out with the right overall zeta potentials. And then the ultimate is the zeta potential of the complete particle, everything that's associated with it. And then remembering that, when we've talked about this earlier in the course, that the targeting process and going through the body to find the diseased cells, quite often what we're doing is we're actually in one way or another stripping off layers. So what happens as we strip off a layer? And one very common one that people will do is to strip off a layer when it's in an acidic environment. For example, in a tumor region which tends to have a low acidic pH, people will design a nanoparticle that actually has the outer layer dissolve, and then the zeta potential can change so that it's a better zeta potential if they want the nanoparticle to actually go inside the cell. So they may actually use the stripping off of a layer to get to the right zeta potential at the previous layer. So again, if you when you design your particles, if you actually look at the zeta potential after each step, then you're going to get a better idea. Am I in the right place? You know, if when that particle goes and gets into an acidic environment next to a tumor, and that outer layer is going to come off because I designed it that way, now what is the zeta potential going to be, and is that where I want it to be to do the next step? Okay, so here's some take-home messages. And again, the zeta potential is not a fixed thing. So you do the chemistry, it's a function of how that particle is in a particular environment. So the tricky thing about it is that you've got to anticipate not only the chemistry when you synthesize it, but what happens in subsequent environments that it goes through. And think about all the different things that are going to happen to it. And again, try to get it to arrange so that it disperses before you worry about it agglomerating again. So that if it gets dispersed, then you can bring the zeta potential down to increase the circulation time. So everything is interacting by zeta potential. Now, if that weren't hard enough, one of the things that you're trying to do in many cases is to bring a nanoparticle inside a cell. And when you do that targeting process, remember, if you go into, for example, into an endosome, we talked last lecture about entry, and quite often the nanoparticles will go initially into an endocytic vesicle, which typically has a pretty high pH, somewhere around anywhere from pH 4 to 6. So it can be a pretty acidic environment. And when that happens, the zeta potential of the particle is going to change. So what you'll see when you go read papers out in the literature, they'll say, I know my particle is going to get caught in an endosome initially, and so what I've designed is that the outer layer of that particle gets stripped away in that acid environment, the zeta potential changes, and the zeta potential helps pull it across and out of the endosome to go back into the cytoplasm. So they'll actually use that as a way to get it back out of the endosome. And different parts, remember we talked about the different compartments that are in cells. A cell is not a simple sac bilipid layer with cytoplasm on the inside and a nucleus somewhere in there. It's complex compartments. You have a lot of membranous material in the Golgi apparatus. There are mitochondria. There are many, many membranous structures in there. And they all have different pH and ionic strength. And the cell is able to keep very, almost in some ways, very conflicting environments. You would be surprised that all of the deadly things that are inside your cells that are kept in subcompartments. And as long as they're in the right subcompartment, the cell is fine, which is why, you know, I've advised you against, in general, trying to just kill cells and spill their contents, because cells have not only acidic contents, but they have a lot of, some cells have high concentrations of hydrogen peroxide and other things which are extremely destructive. And they get out and get released. If they stay inside their compartments, they're just fine. So it's amazing all of the different subcompartments that you have inside your cells with very different microenvironments. Think about where your nanoparticle is designed to go, and think about at that stage what is going to be the zeta potential at that particular multi-step targeting process that I want it to go to. Now, this, I know this sounds, the way that I'm picturing this, this sounds like, wow, this is very difficult. How can I ever design a particle? Well, trust me, you can and you will. And people do it. Usually they do it more empirically than but after a while, if they're actually doing this, they learn and they start, they still empirically sort of walk in their particle design to be able to get it right. They don't usually sit there and calculate it, but they'll do certain things to either raise or lower zeta potentials at different times to be able, at different layers, because they know approximately what it's going to be. And then the ultimate proof is how well does the particle work. So don't get, I want to have you understand a little bit of the theory behind this and what's happening, but I don't want you to obsess on it, and I want you to think about it as a guide to help you. It's not that your first experiment's going to get it perfect, but hopefully with a little bit of theoretical guidance, you'll get it in 3 or 4 tries rather than 20 or 30 tries. Okay, so that's why you need to think about this, unless you want to do 20 or 30 tries. But most people don't. This gives you an example of the zeta potential versus pH. And what I've tried to do in this graph is show you that there are stable regions, and this is stable and monodispersed, meaning the particles will be quite happy at both a very high negative or positive zeta potential. Again, if you're working with cell cultures and you're just transfecting things into a homogeneous cell line, then you can go and use a positive charged nanoparticle up in this region. As you bring the zeta potential down, at some point when it gets close to zero, you'll reach the isoelectric point. And then your particle, nanoparticle complex, which is usually also somewhat held together by charge properties, your nanoparticle complex will start becoming unstable. And you may start having the structures start to come apart. So you want to think about that. You don't want to be at a zeta potential of 0 millivolts, but you want to stay, as I said, in vivo, you'll stay usually slightly negative to that and stay somewhere in the region of between about -5 and, let's say, -15 millivolts will be a good first guess. If you don't know anything else, try that as a guess. As you go to different organs, it will have different susceptibilities. And it's interesting because the kidney is very sensitive to zeta potential. So that's the other place that it takes out particulate matter that's in the, that it's filtering. So, that's another place to watch it. This is a little hard to see. It's talking, and I'll try to get a clearer, version of this figure for you. But basically, it's taking different, molar concentrations of, potassium nitrate. So basically adding ion sources, to the fluid. And what I'm trying to do with that is say that ionic strength, as a function, here we have the, zeta potential on the y-axis and pH again on the x-axis. And as you, change the relative concentrations of these ions that you're adding, then the overall, ionic strength of the solution, will change as a function of pH because you're forming complexes in there. So you got to be constantly aware that even your ionic strength of your fluid will change. And then one that you won't think about very often is that if you dilute back, and that quite often things get diluted, as the ionic strength gets diluted, then the zeta potential can change. And I think I've got a slide coming up that was a real surprise to us when we first discovered that, because nobody had ever talked about that before. Okay, we're measuring, how do you measure zeta potential? It's nice to say get the zeta potential correct, but how do people actually do that? There's a number of different ways, but basically what you're doing is you're putting charged particles, let's say your nanoparticles or your cells, in between either a positive and a negative electrode, and you put a particular electric field strength, and what you'll do is cause those particles to move. Now, if we just kept them on as a constant voltage, then pretty soon all the positive particles would come here, hit this, and we basically have our experiment stop. So what you do instead is you're constantly using an alternating field. So you're going back and forth. And so what's happening is these particles are actually oscillating back and forth, back and forth. And now how fast they go back and forth and how far they go is dependent, obviously, on since the electrodes are basically, we know what that voltage is, then it's going to depend on the charge properties here, but it's also going to depend on a couple of other things. One of the things it's going to depend on is the hydrodynamic radius. In other words, you're pushing this thing back and forth against a fluid. So the bigger the particle is, the more fluid it has to push out of the way. So you're getting something as it's in here back and forth. You're getting something which is going to depend on the cross-sectional area of the particle in the direction of motion. It's also going to depend on the fluid. Now that's something people forget sometimes. They'll measure the zeta potential in a particular fluid, and they'll get an incorrect idea of what it's really going to be in the final fluid. So you should try to get something. If you think that you're going to put this into the bloodstream, you probably should try to approximate the salt water ionic strength and pH of a bloodstream, and then get something that, so when you make this measurement, it's going to come close to what the zeta potential will be in blood. If you put that into a highly viscous fluid, obviously things are going to move more slowly. So as people make the mistake sometimes, they'll make concentrated nanoparticles in some kind of a viscous solution, and they'll get a very, and if you don't tell the machine what the viscosity of the fluid is, the machine doesn't know. So it's gonna use whatever default value it has in there. And you'll get an incorrect zeta potential. So think about that. There's a dielectric constant here. If you have protein in the fluid, as I mentioned before, like bovine serum albumin that you've added, and you would want to do that. If you're approximating, a lot of people think, oh, I'll use physiological saline. I'll just use a salt water solution, like a 0.8% salt water solution to approximate blood. I say that's fine, except that there's actually quite a bit of protein in blood. So therefore, the dielectric constant of the medium is going to be quite different. So you want to add some protein source back so that the dielectric constant is similar, because ultimately that's going to affect what the real zeta potential is going to be in the microenvironment. You can get a pretty accurate picture of what it's going to be when you actually make those measurements. So here's an equation showing you some of those things. So when we move something back and forth in an electric field, that's called the electrophoretic mobility. And what we have here is the electrophoretic mobility is related to the zeta potential by a few factors here. One is the dielectric constant, as I said, and that's going to be affected by a protein source. We have something affected by the viscosity, inversely proportional to the viscosity here. And then we have a fudge factor called Henry's function, which is sort of the constant of proportionality here between these two factors. So when we put our nanoparticles in different types of media, if we have a polar media versus nonpolar media, we'll get a very different slip plane. And Henry's function is trying to approximate what's happening for this slip plane in here. And there's two different ones that are used, Sokol Huckel and Shmolakowski's approximations for what this hydrodynamic radius is going to be in that situation. So when you tell it, when you basically, usually these zeta sizing machines will ask you information about the whether it's polar or nonpolar. It'll ask you some things about the viscosity. What it's doing is it's taking that information in so that it can, when it's measuring the electrophoretic mobility back and forth, it can go back to that previous slide. It will know sort of what to use for this proportionality function right here, the Henry's function, in order to be able to get the correct value for this. Again, it's a calculated function. So we're making assumptions about what that slip layer is, because we have to, in order to solve this equation for Z, for the zeta potential, then we have to basically measure the electrophoretic mobility. These things are known about the fluid, the viscosity, and the dielectric medium. If you input that to the machine, then it's going to make an assumption based on polar or nonpolar of what value to put here for Henry's function in order to back calculate the zeta potential. So it's not magic, and it could make a mistake if you give it the wrong information. So overall, what we're trying to do, in general, what I'm teaching you is how to make targeted nano drug delivery systems. And as part of that targeting, what we're doing is we're using targeting molecules on the nanoparticle systems that you make that have these particles and maybe a drug attached to it. And what you're doing is you're overcoming all of these electrical potential barriers in a fluid. So when you start looking at that, it's rather interesting that you have, here's your standard thing, again, looking back at the zeta potential of the surface charge, the various layers which move immediately, the counter ion layer that moves with the particle, and then the more extended one, and then the zeta potential, how that distance from the particle. But what you're really looking at is you're looking at the overall net force. So if you look at this in terms of attractive forces and repulsive forces, and you actually put those two together. So we have an electrical repulsion going down exponentially away as a function of distance. We have also an attractive force, which is increasing as you get closer, particularly van der Waal forces, as they get closer together, and then you start grabbing across potential barriers. Then you end up with a net repulsive barrier that looks somewhat like this curve in this figure. And that is, so what you're trying to do is to bring through random collisions your nanoparticle close enough so that it gets over this potential barrier and then finds hopefully its receptor and then grabs a hold of it, and then it becomes a stable complex. So you're creating a little bit of a barrier because you don't want things just sticking non-specifically or mistargeting, as we said. Because what happens if it mistargets? I mean, the whole purpose of what we're trying to do is target a drug delivery. If it mistargets, then we have the same side effect problems and damage to other tissues, normal tissues and organs, that we get with untargeted conventional drug delivery. So if we don't do a good job with this targeting, then we've kind of given up the advantages of a targeted nano drug delivery system. So think about that, all of these forces coming together. Again, it's a little daunting to try to predict this, but you'll get a good feel. After you do this, start doing this for a while, you'll get a little better idea. And then what I recommend that you do is learn to do these targeting experiments. Do it first in vitro. That's why we talked earlier about cytometry-type measurements that we can make either with a flow cytometer or an image cytometer, that we can actually measure what did our nanoparticle do that we had the zeta potential designed to target to those cells. How well did it target to the right cells? And we can actually measure the mistargeting. And we can, so all of this, you can walk your way experimentally in from some rough, I would say rough guesses, educated guesses as to what you've done if you get the zeta potential closer. And then you can just simply make quantitative measurements cell by cell, either again with a flow cytometer or image cytometer, and see how well you did. So it's not, it's again ultimately going to be empirical, because there are a lot of factors there that are very hard to calculate. Okay, people are constantly asking me this question, say, what is the best zeta potential? And the first thing I tell them is, well, that's a complicated question, so I can't give you a simple answer. And so the general rule of thumb is that if you don't know anything else, start with something in the range of -5 to -15 millivolts once it's in solution. You can have it a little more than that, -20, -30 when it's in a bottle on the bench, but when you're actually in the solution that you think you're going to do it. Remember that most biological cells have zeta potentials in that same range. So you can also measure, particularly if you're doing, let's say you're doing a nanomedical system that is going to target to leukemia or lymphoma cells in the bloodstream. You can actually measure the zeta potentials of those target, the cells that you're trying to target, of the type of cell that it is. You can get something very close to what the actual target cell is, put them in a zeta sizer and actually measure it. And what you'll find is that it can vary quite a bit. Don't assume that a cancer cell, like a B cell cancer cell is going to be the same as a normal B cell. It won't be. It's going to have probably quite a different zeta potential. So try to get something that you get an idea about what that will be, and then design something that will not stick non-specifically to it. And then how much that final zeta potential should be, if you have a slight repulsion, is going to depend on how good your targeting mechanism is. If you have an antibody which is very tightly linked, then it will pull it across the barrier more than if one is looser. We call those avidities of antibodies or peptides or aptamers. What is the avidity? The strength of the interaction. So the stronger the interaction is, the more forgiving your system's going to be when you try to get the zeta potential for this. If you've got a very mild interaction that's not very strong to start with, that's going to make this much more difficult. So that's a good reason to try to have. And if you do a receptor ligand bonds, you want to have it strong enough to overcome at least modest electrical repulsions. Otherwise, you may never get it to bind. And again, this reminder, if all you want to do is have the nanoparticles stick to cells and tissue culture for transfection, just make the zeta potential positive and be done with it. Don't worry about all of this. Just go ahead and do it. But here's one that you don't think about. So you've got your cells growing in a lawn, and you're testing out your system, and you say, oh, I've got negative charges on these cells. Guess what the charge is on your tissue culture plate? It's positive. So let's say about a third of the area is of your tissue culture plate is filled with cells, and two-thirds of it are in between cells. What's going to happen when you put your negatively charged nanoparticles onto those? They're going to go immediately and stick to the tissue culture plate. We actually had this happen recently in some of our organ on a chip experiments, because the charge properties were wrong. We had to then recoat the tissue culture plates to make them not as positively charged, so that we didn't have all our nanoparticles go immediately to the tissue culture plate. That's one that surprises people. They say, why didn't my cells label? It all went down there, and all the nanoparticles are between the cells. Well, it's because the zeta potential of the tissue culture plate was highly positive. You put highly negative ones there together, they're going to bind very fast and easy. Okay, let's talk about a few zeta potential experiences, and I'm going to give you this paper. Again, it's a what I call a nice paper for teaching purposes, because I actually had a new graduate student at the time, Bill Rose, for whom a good part of his thesis was going to be on zeta potential sizing. And so we did a lot of layer-by-layer assembly with Yuri Lavov, who is a well-known scientist in the field of layer-by-layer polymer assembly. This was a collaboration between our two labs. So what we did with that, and you will see some of this in the literature, people where they take polymers of opposite charges. So you start out with, for example, a negatively, you can have a solid substrate, and then, which is negatively charged, you then have a positively charged polymer, which then sticks to that. So this might be your core material that you're building on. And then you come along with a negatively charged one, which sticks to the positively charged layer. Now, this can get a little tricky because they can have differing amounts of charges. So if you're thinking about what's the zeta potential of this, you start having layers and you start measuring the zeta potential, you get some interesting properties. So along the y-axis again is zeta potential, and then along the x-axis is the number of layers. And so we're actually adding, each time we add a layer, we go in opposite directions, right? As we go add positive or negative layers, we make the zeta potential go in the opposite direction. But then as you start getting more layers, then things get more complicated, and it's not quite as simple as the initial wide swings that you get, because you're going to start oscillating around a value because you're making less and less difference as you get out to a high number of layers. So this just shows that. Now, the other thing that I'm showing in this is that we actually did some zeta sizing, dynamic light scattering sizing. And what you find is, as you add layers, is that in general, the hydrodynamic radius of the particles increased pretty linearly up to a point. And then when you start getting oscillations like this, those are not very believable. I think we were having some problems with the charge properties, such that it was not having a well-defined dynamic boundary. But you see, in general, every time we added a layer, we added size to it, as you would expect. And that's, in fact, one of the things that we do when we construct nanoparticles and we add a layer. We check by dynamic light scattering, we check to see, did it get bigger or not? Because sometimes you thought you added a layer. Just because you did the chemistry doesn't mean that it necessarily happened successfully. So you have to test that and say, did I add a layer? So it doesn't exactly prove that you put what you had on there. And we're going to have an upcoming lecture on X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy where you can say, did I get those atoms there and that chemical bond on the actual nanoparticle? That's what you have to do if you actually want to look at the chemistry and say, do I really have what I think I have on there? But a fast, indirect, easy measurement that people often do, which lends, as we said, lends credence to the idea that they actually added a layer, is to do a dynamic light scattering and show that they increase the size. Okay, this was an interesting experiment, effects of pH and dilution. And what I've got is basically a zeta potential on the y-axis and then a function of on the top graph of time and looking at stability. So this is saying, how long can you make a nanoparticle and have it stay so that it's still useful? And what we did in this study was that we actually did at a particular pH, we did the effects of putting it into a solution and then diluting it back with water so that the ionic strength was less. And you see what ends up happening with that is that we end up, as we dilute these, and these are two different pHs at 6.4 and 7.4, you see what ends up happening is here is that as we dilute this out and drop the ionic strength, the zeta potential, in this case, we made a fairly dramatic change from about minus 50 millivolts down to about minus 70 or 75, so about a fairly huge change just by diluting. Now, why would we do something like that? Again, it's this thing that we have things at an ionic strength in the bottle when we did the chemistry, and then we put it into the bloodstream. Well, what if it goes into a part of the body in which the ionic strength really drops, which is the equivalent of doing a dilution like this with water? An example might be the kidneys, for example. Okay? So the zeta potential is going to really change. So if you were trying to actually go to that organ, you're going to expect that you would undergo some dilution and the zeta potential would drop. In the bottom part of this graph, we have the zeta potential, and again, it's all negative starting here, going on down. We've expanded the scale so that you can see the differences. And then looking at the pH as it basically drops to a more acidic, more physiological at about 7.2, 7.3 pH down to a more acidic at, let's say, pH 6.4, we said, well, what happens to that if we dilute it? And what we found was that as we did a tenfold dilution here, so the stability was pretty good. We were able to keep this over a period of time and the pH strength, so it was pretty constant. But if it diluted, then we dropped about almost 10 units in millivolts, 10 millivolts, in terms of its zeta potential. So these are things to keep in mind. Again, this is something that just nobody had ever reported. So we stuck that in the paper saying, oh, by the way, you might want to pay attention to this because nobody had really thought about it and we had run into this problem. Okay, so let's summarize this and then I'm going to go very quickly into some dynamic light scattering, a very quick overview of that. So the summary of zeta potential properties of nanoparticles is that the zeta potential is the electrical potential at that shear plane, which is where the fluid still moves with the particle, either with the cell or the nanoparticle. The electrical property determines whether that solution that you made will agglomerate all together. That's every time you see something agglomerate, that says that the zeta potential is such that it's going to cause the particles to agglomerate. And you've got to change the zeta potential if you want that to prevent that. Zeta potential needs to be determined and controlled at each step. Again, sometimes you can't. You're adding. You really need to add a specific molecule, so you might have to add an auxiliary molecule that may or may not have a function just to get the charge properties right, back into the right balance. Okay, because sometimes the molecules you want, those electrical properties are what they are, and you can't change them. And it's probably not worth you trying to change them. I mean, chemists spend a lot of time trying to add groups to molecules to change their charge properties. But I think when you're making a nanoparticle, the better thing to do might be to add a different molecule that has overall the charge properties that are going to help you get to your endpoint. And then thinking about, again, what is the complete nanoparticle and what is it going to be at each stage along the process in a multi-step targeting process. Okay, let's talk a little bit about sizing. I showed you a graph showing an increase in sizing. You say, how do people do those measurements? How do you actually size something? And the first thing that you might say is, well, if I want to look at how big a nanoparticle is, I'll do electron microscopy on it. Now, you say, what's wrong with that idea? Well, what's wrong with that idea is electron microscopy is done in typically in a vacuum environment, so it's going to be a non-aqueous environment. And what that means is it's going to be an artificial environment. So electron microscopy is okay for looking at the core materials of a nanoparticle, but it's not going to tell you much about, first of all, unless some of the other layers have electron-dense atoms in them, you're not even going to see those layers. So that's one that surprises many people. They look at their nanoparticles that have all of these molecules and polymers and many layers, and all they see is the core particle, because none of those other ones that they added molecules are electron dense. So that's one reason why. The second is that we ultimately have to have this thing function. We want to know what is its size in solution, and so we have to be able to measure it under those circumstances. Now, we could do this, and our lab does this sometimes. We can do this by atomic force microscopy, where we can put it into an aqueous. We have so-called bio-AFMs, atomic force microscopes, over at the Birk Nanotechnology Center, and we can then make measurements in an aqueous environment, which is more physiologically relevant. But the problem is, again, kind of like the problem with electron microscopy, is that you only get to sample a few things. So it's very hard to make a large number of measurements on a large number of particles. So it very quickly becomes the rate limiting step is how many measurements can you actually make. So what we can do, and it's a very arduous process. So people, again, do zeta dynamic, zeta sizing or dynamic light scattering sizing in a zeta machine because it's pretty fast and it's pretty easy and it gives you a pretty good quick measurement. Now, so we'll talk a little bit about what that does and what it doesn't do. It's also called photon autocorrelation spectroscopy is the real name for it. But you'll usually hear it talked about, at least in the context of nanoparticle sizing, as a dynamic light scattering measurement. So we're trying to get the intensity of that scattering autocorrelation curve. It's basically a light scattering curve, and all of these measurements are typically done with a laser beam, although some of them are starting to be made with some kinds of small nanophotonic devices rather than a laser beam. And then, again, what we've got with these kinds of measurements is it's very complex, and there are assumptions made about the measurements, and then there are calculations that come in there. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And when you actually do a so-called deconvolution of the intensity or autocorrelation curve, and you try to change it into an intensity distribution, it's a very ill-defined problem. And in fact, different vendors do it differently, and each one will argue about whether their result is better. And of course, they can do that. They can argue about which one is better, because nobody knows what the truth is. You know, how do you make the actual measurement? And the answer is you need the measurement to make the measurement. So people will argue endlessly about whether their measurements are better or worse, and there's no way to solve the argument. The inherent uncertainty, then, ultimately, the reason I'm telling you this is the uncertainty factor translates ultimately into a peak broadening. So usually you've got the average size correct, but you don't know what the actual distribution of sizes is. And I'm going to show you an actual curve coming up. And so typically you'll actually add to the dispersion of the measurement because of this uncertainty in the calculation that makes the measurement look worse than it really is. This is one of those few things that you've actually done something better than what the measuring process says it is. So let me show you an example of that. So this is what we're doing is we have a large number of particles scattering off a laser beam, and then the angle between that determines lots of things about the actual way you calculate the distribution, and different machines will take this angle either in backscatter mode, which is what we're talking about here, or sometimes in so-called forward scatter mode. So I'm going to show you one in particular, and I'll show you the machine that we have next door. And then you're taking all of these things into account. Again, these things move around by Brownian motion, as you know, when you get very small things. And so there's a lot of things that diffusion coefficients, temperature, viscosity, that you have to know some of those things in order to make these calculations. And again, coming up with the hydrodynamic radius, as shown here, which is a function of all of those things, including the thermal effects of this. So you have to know the temperature. So you end up ultimately coming back in some way or other, usually with some correction factors, and again, everybody does the correction factors a little different, the Stokes-Einstein equation, to be able to calculate what that hydrodynamic radius is. And that hydrodynamic radius, remember, and this is the one thing you've got to remember, is that you have your particle, your actual nanoparticle radius, and then you have the hydrodynamic radius, which is going to be a little different. The hydrodynamic radius is always going to be a little larger than your real nanoparticle size, because the counter ions in the fluid are clinging to it. So it's moving not only the particle, but it's moving the ions around the particle. And that makes the particle, the apparent diameter, a little bigger than it really is. So keep that in mind as you're making this calculation, or the machine does this calculation for you. So here's an example. And this particular one is from the different Malvern. I just took this from Malvern's catalog. They have different zeta sizers that do things at different angles. And the idea is to be sensitive to different things. The backscatter is very sensitive to very small things, so that we have a nano ZS zeta sizer next door, which has a backscatter then at 173 degrees. If it was 180, it would be right back at the source. So 173 is pretty high. But what that means is that it can size things very, very small down to about, the resolution is on the order of about 0.6 nanometers diameter. So that's pretty small, about the smallest object that it can really see. And then it has a pretty wide dynamic range. And that's where things get a little bit trickier, because quite often what you have is a range of particle sizes. And you may have some very big things in there, and as well as some little things. And if you put nanoparticles and cells in there, think about how big. Remember, a cell is on the order of a million times bigger than a nanoparticle. So these particular ones, they try to take that into account so that you can do real experiments. And so, for example, I believe the range for the Nano ZS that we have is about 0.6 nanometers on the low end and about 6 microns on the upper end. That's a huge dynamic range. And if the cells are bigger than that, or the object's bigger than that, then it really can't handle that measurement. So, you gotta know something about what the, and about what the angular ranges are, and then as a result of that is what is the sensitivity of the smallest objects. You know, if you're only gonna measure microparticles, for example, and, you know, a micron or above, then you can get more accurate measurements perhaps at 90 degrees than you can at 173. And that's why in a flow cytometer, we typically do a lot of size-related measurements at 90 degrees away from the beam. But that's for micron-sized particles. But when you get them much smaller than that, then that doesn't work very well at 90 degrees. And you need to get, so smaller particles will typically need a backscatter rather than a side scatter system. So here's some types of measurements that you'll get. In this particular one, from a sample from Malvern here, is basically a relative number in the class, and we have equal numbers of 5 nanometer and 50 nanometer size particles. So if we actually calculate a number for these, and sometimes you want to know that, what is the relative amount? If I have a size distribution, I want to know, what fraction of the nanoparticles are of this size versus another size. So you want to get something that is sensitive to the actual number on that. Sometimes, depending again on what you're trying to do, and you can see in this particular case, if you have a 50 nanometer, size particle and you're measuring volume, that's huge because it's 50 cubed versus 5 cubed. So that's a huge dynamic range. Most of the volume of particles in there is actually in that 50, even though there's equal numbers of 5 and 50 nanometer particles. And then lastly, the same thing, because intensity tends to go roughly as relating more to the volume, and the bigger particles scatter in intensity much, much greater than the smaller ones do. So you have to take that into account. So this shows you again, you can make all of these types of calculations with the Zeta Sizer. So this graph is showing you what I told you about the actual versus the measured. Now, when you say measured in a dynamic light scattering sizer, it's not really measured. It's measured and calculated. And that's where, because of that very ill-defined function going between the autocorrelation function to calculate intensities, it's just a very rough calculation, and it widens the distribution. So here's an example of that, where your actual, if you actually did a size distribution, let's say by electron microscopy, it would be like as shown here in blue. And then we would have, so that would be the actual distribution is pretty tight, but that in fact in red, we would see that we had a much wider distribution, so it looks much worse than it really is. So think about that. The measurements tend to be pretty close to what the actual, you know, for the peak value, tends to be pretty close to what the actual value is, but the dispersion around that looks, it almost always looks much worse than your actual particles are. That's one of those rare things where what you did is better than what the measurements tell you it is. So keep that in mind as you're doing this. If you think, gee, why is my distribution so broad, and work very hard at that, and you may not be able, no matter how hard you work, you will not be able to make the red curve ever become like the blue curve, because it has to do with the way that measured dynamic light scattering measurement is actually measured and calculated. So keep that in mind so that you don't spend a lot of time trying to do something beyond what you can actually measure. So with that, I'm just going to show you these references. Again, I've taken you through a fair. I'm not pushing in any way Malvern, except that we've got a lot of Malvern instruments on this campus, and they've been in this business for a very long time, and they do quite an excellent job in educational things. So I've given you the links for these, so you can go, and in many cases, these are nice animations and ways to learn a little bit more about that. For example, the Zeta Potential, an introduction in 30 minutes. These are pretty good ones to do. I've given you I will put it on the website after the lecture here, the paper from our group showing the layer-by-layer assembly and some of the effects, and we discussed some of that about in terms of dilutions. And then lastly, there are not, if you actually go and you look out in the literature, it's very hard to find things if you do searching by zeta potential alone. You won't find a large number of papers. And so what I did want to do was try to find at least one paper for you where they did at least a reasonably good job looking at the zeta potential to probe the interactions of nanoparticles with normal and human breast cancer cells. So they actually went through a little bit of the design process. And then after this lecture, you can go and read that paper and critique it and see if you think they did a good job, see if they made their assumptions right or not. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions that you might have. Yes?
So referring back to your slides on size and zeta potential changes during layer-by-layer technique construction of nanoparticles, you have two graphs. One of them, you said, as you increase the number of layers that you coat onto the nanoparticles, the charge does not start becoming less affected by the change for your layers. So, what do you think is the reason for that?
Okay, so if I summarize the question, is that as you start adding and layer by layer assembly, initially when we put the first layer or two on, we see wide oscillations as we go from, let's say we start out with a positive layer, so we have a positive zeta potential, and then we add a negative layer and it goes, oscillates down to a very negative zeta potential. And as we add more and more, remembering that the zeta potential is what is, in a sense, is the sum of all of those things put together, and as the charges start to rearrange and mingle and you start making these structures, then the effect of adding another layer is not as extreme as you might if you start adding up what the net charges are. You won't get as much of an effect as you had initially, where you added a pure charge. You know, the most dramatic one is going to be the first one onto the core material. You see a huge swing there, and then when you add the next layer on, it was a huge swing back. You'll do that for a while, but then they will start. I'm not sure I can give you a really good explanation for exactly why the calculated amounts, because you could sit there and try to say, well, how many charges am I actually adding? But it has to do with the fact that when you start making these complexes and you start pushing the charges together, there's also some collapsing of the structure and insulation effects, because each layer will partly insulate from the next layer, because those are polymers. So they're not only charge layers, but they're also insulating layers. So there is a partial shielding effect of the previous layers. I'm not sure that's probably the best explanation I can come up with in simple terms for you. So think about the shielding effects. It's not just charges. You're also adding polymer and proteins and other things which add a dielectric to it and therefore change the overall perceived charge as you start getting to the outside. So it's shielding more inner charges, so you don't see they don't just add together in a simple linear way. But very good question. Yes?
You said that the normal and disease cells have different zeta potentials?
They can. They can, and quite often. So the question is, I said that normal and disease cells can have of a particular type, like a B cell lymphoma versus a normal B cell, for example, is the one I cited. What can happen is that when a cell becomes diseased, in this case, it becomes diseased typically due to gene rearrangements, then quite often the zeta potential of a cancer cell will end up, it'll become much more highly charged on the surface, and some of that process can help it during a metastasis process in finding its way out through tissue. And it just, the gene regulation is usually badly messed up. So it's used to its normal environment, and it's basically evolved itself a zeta potential, which works well. You think about, remember I mentioned about how nature designs things that work? Not necessarily the best design, but one that works. So if you have things that are designed, cells that are designed to live in a certain environment, they will more or less select themselves for what's going to be a good zeta potential for that. Quite often what happens with a cancer cell, for example, is that it evolves a different design and one that's not very appropriate. And one little known fact is that when you have a metastasis of a cancer, it's been calculated that a probability of success of a cancer cell going from a primary tumor and then metastasizing to some local different environment, some other part of the body, is on the order of 1,000,000 to 1 odds. So it's a very improbable event. Most cancer cells never survive that process. And one of the reasons is that they have a bunch of properties. It can be pH requirements, it can be ionic strength requirements, it can be the zeta potential, such that it cannot survive in those microenvironments. In other ones, it can be attracted to. For example, quite often metastatic cancer cells, actually we say home to particular organs. A very particular example of that I gave you earlier in the semester about prostate cancer. Prostate cancer normally grows very, very slowly when it's in the prostate. If you get a cell which metastasizes from the prostate to bone, then that is one of the things that has molecules on it that target it to bone cells. If it does that successfully, it then grows about 20 times faster. Then that is when people contract a metastatic advanced prostate cancer and they die. It's because all of a sudden that very rare instance, but when it was growing very, very slowly at the primary site and all of those properties changed, it found a very successful new niche where if you put it in a bone environment, it basically goes haywire and grows at almost 20 times its normal rate and then takes over and destroys the bone. Typically, these people will develop bone fractures, among other things. Among other things, the zeta potential on those, and if you study cancer cells that have been, you know, certainly cancer cell lines, that may not be a fair comparison, but even cancer cells that have been isolated from metastatic tumors and so on, that their zeta potentials, among other things, can be very different. Good question. Yes.
On that.
Yes.
You said during metastasis, the cells become more positive charge. So comes that be used to target nanoparticle, maybe more negative charge.
Okay. So the question is, during cancer or some disease, if the zeta potential of the cells changes enough, could you use that as a targeting mechanism in and of itself? I haven't seen that done as a pure targeting mechanism, but my guess is that it is happening in some of the systems that are designed out there, because many systems, even when they're not targeting, they'll put a polymer on their nanoparticles, and then they find with leaky vasculature and so on, the first of all, the nanoparticles tend to cluster there, but they may also end up with, if you will, a somewhat targeting effect because the zeta potentials may be favorable to the particles. I haven't seen people do that in a very studied way, and maybe I haven't missed those papers, but the answer is you could do it. My guess is that that would be a little bit subtle. You might be able to achieve that, but I think your better strategy is still to use some kind of a targeting molecule receptor type thing, if you have it. Now, sometimes you don't have a targeting molecule. We don't know what the biomarker is, in which case people say, well, these cells tend to be more positively charged, these disease cells. We don't have a marker for it, so we can, in that case, make use of what you suggest in terms of taking a zeta potential, which is going to be more favorable to do it. And then it's a little bit of a chance encounter. So you're, as I said earlier about the effects of the advantages of a targeted approach versus an untargeted, you're going to be somewhere in between. So you maybe do a little better than you would with totally untargeted conventional drug delivery, but perhaps not as good as if you had a highly targeted molecule. But that's it. That's a certainly a very valid way to go, particularly when there is no known molecule to target to, no biomarker on the disease cell. Other questions? Okay, if there are no more questions, I'll see you on Thursday and hopefully see some of your smiling faces tomorrow at the Malvern Symposium.